Talk given Friday evening, 16th June 1972. In the old days in India, there was no writing, no books. Therefore, people learned only through personal contact with the teacher, by listening to the spoken word. And in those days, where the religious life was concerned, the teacher had to be a true teacher. That is to say, one who had realized for himself that which was given out by word of mouth. And as far as the religious life was concerned, this realization by the teacher excluded any speculative thinking. This is very important to bear in mind. As and when somebody produced a system of philosophy, speculative thought had its place. But where the religious life was concerned, there was no speculative thinking involved. Because the teaching concerning the religious life is a practical teaching. It is a doing. It is not just wondering and imagining what is the truth, what is the right, or whatever the question at issue might be. It wasn't an intellectual exercise. That was for the philosophers. But for the religious teachers, it had to be a case of personal inward realization before they could honestly be regarded as religious teachers, and for their part to have the inner honesty and integrity, the truthfulness, to be willing to teach. Now, when such people taught, they were people who had profound insight into human nature. If they met somebody who wanted to live the religious life, they knew him. They didn't merely size him up, as we would say in modern times, but they knew him just by his being in their presence. Now, this has a tremendous significance as to the nature of the religious teacher. It gives us some idea of the sort of person who can be a true religious teacher. One who knows you when he sees you, when he meets you. And because he knew the person whom he met, the teacher knew the person who came to him, in that way, he gave the person what was essential for him, for his welfare, and his real spiritual growth. like a skilled gardener who knows what to do for the plants, because he has all the knowledge as well as the physical skill and technique. So too these people, these teachers, gave to the particular person what was essential for them. You will see one of the important points at issue here. The spiritual life is the spiritual life, a living process, a growing process, dealing with an organism, not with a mechanism. And therefore, the teaching regarding the living of the religious life was not a mere technique, not a mere laid down routine. Do this, that, and the other, and such results ought to come. That belongs much more to the realm of the machine, not to the realm of the organism. The machine one controls exactly according to one's will, and it will do the needful because it is the machine you made. The organism you do not control. You interplay with it, and in that interplay, if the teacher is truly wise, truly a teacher, truly capable, that living person grows from within. This is very important. So you see, the extraordinary part, therefore, that was played in this relationship between teacher and disciple, the extraordinary part played by what we call the spiritual values, love, wisdom, purity, and so on, in their transcendence and perfection. And the whole relationship and the process of growth of the disciple was a thing of beauty which perfectly fitted into the life of the total environment, into the life of nature itself. Now we must bear this in mind carefully and note the contrast with our own times. That day and age has practically disappeared. The modern world is a very different world. No longer is it a case of the teaching by word of mouth from the realized being. Today there are hundreds, literally thousands of books. There is no discriminatory process taking place. If a person is interested, and he may just have a very superficial interest, he just wants some intellectual excitement maybe, or he wants some relief from personal sorrow, or the satisfaction of his own inner urges and views as regards the spiritual life, etc., etc. So many things come in. He has all these and he approaches, he takes a book, he goes to lectures, he joins societies and so forth. This wonderful discriminatory process is absent on the whole. It takes place up to a point, but nowhere near comparable to the degree in which it took place in the old days when there was no writing, no books available. By wholesale dissemination of knowledge, there is inevitably a lowering of standards. The level of mediocrity, so to say, rises. This does not mean that knowledge shouldn't be made available to anybody and everybody. But this is a fact. This is what has happened, especially where the religious life is concerned. Those who are in positions of authority or conducting groups of people or dealing with individuals haven't got quite the same, usually nowhere near the same, expertise, personal realization, this discriminatory perception, which can see clearly precisely what the needs of the living person in front of him are. We haven't got that today. So, bearing all that in mind, we must realize that our personal responsibility is greater than ever, therefore. It rests with each one of us to be completely honest with ourselves, to be serious-minded, not in the sense of being glum or solemn, but serious-minded, in the real sense. And in this context, one of the implications will necessarily be the absence of any sort of personal vested interest in the attempt to live the religious life, to gain some result for oneself, to solve one's own problems, and so forth. One lives the religious life because that is at the very heart of all living as a human being. Human beings live religiously. But the moment we attach any sort of personal desire in relation to the living of the religious life, it becomes the irreligious life. This we must understand very clearly. It is not easy to understand it. One may follow the words, the thoughts, and say, of course, that is obvious, that is logically so. But when I say, oh, of course, that is obvious, simply because I have an intellect which is trained to a certain degree, it will see the logic of it and give its assent to it. But that doesn't mean that I have really understood the point, understood its inner significance as well as all its implications and what it means in terms of practical living. So we must be quite honest with ourselves all the time seriously, but not unhappily. This is important, very important. And try and remain awake all the time, so that we see the living process emerge in every sense, not only, as we commonly say, physically, or intellectually, or aesthetically, but also spiritually, religiously, without ever trying to pin down the meaning of the word religious or spiritual according to our somewhat confused perceptions. We have to let it happen. Life lives us. This is a point of such... It is such a profound point that it is really difficult for the intellect even to begin to see it clearly. Life lives us. And if life lives us, our desires, our ambitions, our plans, our schemes, and everything are obstruction to life living us. So now, let's come again to this business of hearing, of listening. In modern times, this will include reading, studying, and all the rest of it in the ordinary modern sense of the word, because there is no option to that. That is a fact of our existence today. It has to be there. So, we must take that fact in our stride, be even more self-responsible, serious-minded, and watchful that we don't make mistakes. Granted that, then let's look into this business of listening. It is associated with two other aspects: reflection, reflecting about it, about what one hears or reads, and then meditating upon what one hears or reads. Meditating not in the sense of musing. We have talked about this matter before, but we can never talk too much, consider this matter too much, because it's the whole thing, it's the whole process. Now the first point we must bear in mind is that whilst we talk of it as hearing, reflecting, and meditating, all three are part and parcel of a single whole living process. It's a single process. According to the time and the place and one's own situation, mood, or whatever it is, one or the other of these three aspects predominates. So it is convenient to talk of three aspects like that: hearing, reflecting, meditating. Shravana, manana, and nididhyasana. And this belongs not only to the Upanishadic teaching, but in the opening of the Tibetan Bardo, for example, the six Bardos, as they are called, the Book of the Dead, in the Book of the Dead, you will find the introductory verses saying to the disciple, now, be willing to listen, to reflect, and to meditate. Because these three are of fundamental importance. Now, this listening obviously is not just restricted to listening with one's ears to so many words and then letting the brain just construct the thought. That is not all. One listens with faith. That is, not with preconceived beliefs or ideas, but with one's whole heart, with an open heart, ready to examine, to receive, which is quite different from listening with the preconceived attitude that, oh, whatsoever is said is true. When one listens that way, one remembers the words and just repeats the words parrot-like, and nothing happens as far as the living process, which is the spiritual life, is concerned. So one listens with an open heart. And one can't listen with an open heart unless, to start with, there is a fundamental, vital interest in the reality of the religious life and its meaning. There has to be that interest there. And secondly, there has to be real attention. In fact, if the interest is there, you cannot help but attend. Simply because you are interested. Therefore you listen. Therefore you attend. Listening with one's whole heart, with an open mind, is a very difficult task altogether. The faculty to hear with an open heart grows through the years. It is impossible to listen with an open heart straight away. When one approaches the religious life in the serious sense, there are so many forces which have perhaps impelled one to turn to religion. But all those forces, if you examine them carefully, are obstructions to listening with one's whole heart and with an open mind. Because that which has impelled one to turn to the religious life has introduced so many personal desires. I want to get this, that, or the other out of living the religious life. Now the whole heap of those desires must be out. Otherwise one cannot listen with an open mind. One listens with a conditioned mind, with a closed mind, with a mind that is driven by passion. Not the pure passion which is pure love of reality, of truth, but with this frustrated, distorted passion which is in us. So you see how easy it is. For example, when one reads books on the religious life and religious truth and so forth, how easy it is to miss the import of what one reads. A month later, a year later, 10 years later, one rereads, reads and reads and rereads and rereads and says to oneself, how extraordinary, I never saw that before. Why didn't I see it before? Because I was unable to look before. If I could have really looked at what I was reading, I would have taken in the full import of the thing. My mind was not open, therefore I couldn't read. My mind was conditioned by desire, by personal gain, this, that, or the other. So one doesn't get the full import. You take in ordinary life, for instance, in school, if one is not interested in a subject which is being taught at that particular period, and if you just read the book on it, your eyes will be reading it, but your mind just won't take it in. And you say, oh, this is so hard, so difficult, so boring, I don't understand it, I don't like it, and so forth. But if you're gifted in that direction, be it mathematics or geography or history or whatever it is, at the very first reading almost, you have sopped up the whole thing. It's there. Your mind is open, wholly open, unobstructed. This is the important point. But now where the religious life is concerned, the very fact that we wake up to the fact that we have not taken in the import of this, that, or the other is a pointer as to what we ourselves really are. It is our great opportunity to learn. We learn through our mistakes all the time, if we care to learn. Through our misdemeanors, through our so-called failures, those are the great teachers. When we do something which later on we see is not right, or when we omit to do something which later on we see we ought to have done, we are filled with depression, with remorse, and all kinds of things. You know how the Buddha says over and over again to the monks, here are trees, sit down and meditate, don't give yourselves cause for remorse afterwards. You see? But the wise one, in the experiencing of the depression and the remorse, sees it as an opportunity to learn. And if he learns out of that, which is the karmic result of what he did wrong, or of what he omitted to do which was right, then he is indeed growing. He has learnt the lesson. He's learning the lesson. And indirectly, he has heard. If one understands this, really understands it, it is a pillar of strength to us in the process of our living everyday life, and especially that aspect of it which we term the religious life. In that case, the Buddha's last words are not so difficult to carry out. Appamadena sampadeta. Keep going without flagging. So you keep going without flagging. This is where learning the religious life and the hearing part, the shravana, from which the word shravaka, the learner, the disciple, is derived. This is where learning in the context of the religious life is different from learning in any other context, where you have to acquire a skill, a know-how, a piece of knowledge. If you don't acquire that or learn it, well then, that's that, it's separated out, that's a failure, then you have to do something else, and so forth. But in the religious life, whatever happens, one way or the other, you can utilize it to grow religiously. Now, if one understands this, it would help us to be remarkably free of depression, that, oh, I'm not getting along, I've failed, and all that sort of thing. It will also help us to be free of false elation. Oh, I did that well, I'm doing marvelously, I can now, my mind is so clear, and I'm going like a house on fire. And soon there'll be no house but only the fire. And then we come back with a bump to square one, so to say. But understand this, that everything can be turned to advantage to learn, where the religious life is concerned. Hearing then with one's whole heart, and with an open mind. Now this is associated with the reflection part. Now do not think that whilst one is listening to, let us say that we do have a teacher present, and he's speaking. Do not think that when that is taking place, or when you're reading a book, as in modern times we do, you see, about it all, that we are only hearing or reading. There is reflection and meditation taking place simultaneously, but in a considerably minor degree. This is what stands out, the listening or the reading. But reflection must of necessity accompany it, otherwise there is no thought attached to the words. You don't get the mental pattern which is involved with the words. So reflection is going on at the same time. And as and when one sees this or that point fully lit up, as one hears it or reads it, meditation in the deep sense is taking place simultaneously. Because meditation and enlightenment are identical. Enlightenment, meditation, both belong to the state of communion. And the state of communion is one where there is no separation. It is the oneness. It is the state of realization. It is the state of being that which is happening, that which you are seeing. So necessarily, all three are present. But with me as I am, in the imperfect state, in the act of hearing, in the act of reading, that is predominant. Then I say, I reflect about it, which means I start musing about it. I start talking about it in my mind, trying to compare it with this, that, and the other. What I've learned before, what I already know, what somebody else has said, which is contrary to this, and so forth. Now, this is where we must be on our guard. This process is suitable in the ordinary intellectual sphere where debate takes place. Debate between different viewpoints, attitudes, methods, propositions, and so forth. But in the religious sphere, there is no debate going on. It is not a question of proving a point and disproving another point, somebody else's point. No question of that. There is the issue is whole understanding of the total reality present. And what we call the opposites, where views and ideas are concerned, the opposites are both involved in the total reality. And only insofar as we reflect in such a manner that we never lose sight of the total reality is our reflection of real value to us, from the religious point of view. Because you see, when one reflects that way, one takes no sides. There is no enmity. There is no destructive conflict involved in it. There is the tension of activity releasing understanding. But that tension flowers out, ultimately, into whole understanding. Therefore, there is no hate involved in it. And if there's no hate involved in it, delusions and illusions will also be out of the situation. That is to say, whatever delusions and illusions are actually present will all be seen as they are, for what they are, how they originate, and what is their dissolution as illusions and their transformation into understanding and true vision. You see what is implied in religious study, in religious investigation. We have often and often talked of mindfulness, but we have rarely considered investigation, one of the limbs of enlightenment, as the Buddha said, or one of the links in awakening, investigation of the truth. See, it's this kind of investigation so that there is the wholeness all the time, which implies, again, investigate with your whole heart and with an open mind. Now, the third aspect, the meditation aspect, in which, for oneself as one is, in the imperfect state, perhaps flashes of illumination come. If that meditation can be carried out with one's whole heart and with an open mind, the whole process is an illuminating process. What is one of its essential features? This illuminating of the whole mind, of the whole consciousness, keeps one free from acquiring any particular ideas or concepts. do be very careful about this. Do pay attention to this. That in the real illuminating of the mind, it is not that a wonderful new thought has come into being. It isn't that. It is that the mind remains wholly empty of all that obstructs the light of transcendence. It remains wholly empty, but this continuous experiencing, realizing of illumination makes the faculty which the mind possesses innately of unerring insight into whatever is happening, it makes that faculty grow all the time. Now, in the exercise of that faculty, when the necessity arises for communicating something, then the right thought, the right idea, and the right verbal expression will come along. And the unfortunate thing is that the listener clings to the verbal expression, the thought, and says, ah, the teacher has given me the truth. The truth is the absence of the idea, the doctrine, the dogma, the formulation. It is the absence of it. The formulation is there only as a stimulus for the listener to enter into the empty state of the mind. Now, if that is done, then one has realized for oneself that sentence of the Heart Sutra. Here, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So you see, these three aspects, hearing, or listening, or reading, reflecting, and meditating, all play the dominant role in our religious life and growth. Now, the things that obstruct us are what obstructs us is the collection of images and impressions which we have accumulated through the activity of our senses and the discursive mind. Those are the obstructions all along the line. These are responsible for our clinging to a self-concept. They are responsible in the first instance for the emergence of a self-concept, and thereafter to our clinging to the self-concept. The separate, isolated, immortal entity, the self. And to this we relate everything that we receive. Where the sense life is concerned and the sense impressions are concerned, There is no way out of that in the ordinary sense. That must of necessity happen, because you yourself use your eyes to see, your ears to hear, this sight or that sound, etc., etc. So that of necessity happens there. But the way it interferes with the religious life and the emergence of the religious consciousness is this, that it produces in us an almost ineradicable illusion that I have to realize transcendence. It is the totality which comes to fruition through this, the individual person. So when the individual person turns to the religious life, he has to become free of himself. Then he realizes that what he sees and understands and clings to as himself is an opaque, dark obstacle in the way of the truth, the light of the truth. When he sees that, his whole energy directed to the living of the religious life is quite free of all selfness. And you see, practically all the task is done when that happens. When that happens, he finds himself continually in tune with the totality of life. He finds in his own personal consciousness process that the disjunction between chronological time and all that takes place in chronological time, the disjunction of that from psychological time and all that takes place in terms of his emotional and intellectual reactions and responses is out, and there is the perfect rhythm of the two times. The psychological time is in perfect harmony with all that happens in chronological time as such, which means that all his personal desires, his wishing it otherwise, is completely out of the picture. Then he's in the state of peace. And he's in the state of what the Buddha called rapture, tranquility, energy, samadhi, concentration, and zest. Do think about this. You get it? You see, the religious life is the happy life in this transcendent sense of happiness. But you see its implications. Once you have really understood the nature of the task, you have done the task. Because the full understanding of the nature of the task cannot be separated from the actual fulfillment in action. then one lives the moral life in the true sense. Because morality is action. Morality means customary action. Customary action. Now, when customary action, morality, is no longer conditioned by the conflict of duals, good, bad, pleasant, painful, right, wrong, and all that sort of thing, all of which emerges from my own split consciousness, then only transcendent morality is there. One lives in terms of absolute love, wisdom, beauty, truth, goodness, and so forth. Not because one strives to do it, there is no striving now. It just happens naturally. Because that which prevented it happening naturally, which is the same as saying happening physically, is now out of the picture. So you see why the great teachers really taught, however much their teachings may have got distorted through the ages, in writing and in verbal form, what they really taught was that you do not strive to acquire goodness or truth or anything. Strive in the sense of being in conflict with opposites. You let your whole energy flow into it, which will involve that the tension of interaction between complementaries composing the duality. But that is the healthy state, the living state. Life cannot manifest unless there is that element present. The tension, which is necessarily there because of the complementary duals, are in interaction. They are complementary, not conflicting against each other. You let your whole energy flow naturally, and that's a living process.